So let us go on. And the lecture yesterday presented the denotational semantics of PCF, called by name semantics, and the relation, I argued before that operational semantics and denotational semantics are two sides of the same coin, and this can be justified formally. How we relate them, we can say is sound, a denotational semantic is sound if whenever we have this, then the denotation of P is equal to the denotation of C. So if we evaluate to a value via the rules or the operational semantics, then the denotations of the original program and the obtained value must be the same. And then the other property is adequacy. It works in an opposite direction in a certain sense. So whenever P is equal to C, then if the type of P is either star or bool or not. So that's the converse. If the denotations are the same, then using the operational semantics, we can converge to this value, but this is not precisely the converse of this, because this is true for any type of P, and this is true only for the base types, like Booleans and natural and the star type. The thing is, of course, if we convert to a lambda abstraction, then this wouldn't hold, because there are more than one normal form of a function, even if the function have the same denotation. So we've got different terms for divergence, but from the denotational point of view, all of them are divergence. So all of them are equal. But if we restrict this return types of this things to be the data types, then it's true. And this property together, they somehow justify that if you have these two styles of semantics and this property is hold for them, it indicates that this semantics are fit together. So there are more properties about the agreement of the operational semantics and the denotational semantics stronger than this one. These are like the most basic ones. So if you have them, then it's all right. But you might have stronger properties. We don't consider them, but they are more difficult to achieve. And it's nicer than if you can achieve them. But these are like a minimum, and it's sufficient in most of the cases. So and now I can at least state the as a fact that presented call by name as sound and adequate with respect to do this. So that's tricky to prove, and you are not going to do it. But for your information, this is true. Hi. And now then we have this picture for call by name. As I promised, we consider the corresponding situation with call by value. And with call by value, the semantics is not as straightforward as for call by name. And it could be more difficult, but it can be simplified and presented in quite a concise way due to this magic let construct. It's part of the motivation for me to present the semantics to you, because I want to show the use of the let construct. And that's going to be quite important in the future. So first of all, we need to assign a semantics to the types as we did in call by value, in call by need, in call by name. How to do it better. Okay, so I first introduce an auxiliary function. Let's write it as an underscore. Because again, so in call by value, the things are a bit more complicated because you need to talk about values all the time. So in call by name, you can ignore the difference between computations and values. And in call by value, you need a concept of value and a concept of computation explicitly. So, and on the level of type, I also need like interpretation of type seen as values and interpretations of type seen as computations. So this is like an interpretation of n seen as a value. So I interpret natural numbers in this respect as natural numbers, because if I consider it as a value, then it cannot diverge. It's not a program that outputs numbers. It's just a number, and hence there is no bottom here. Same thing for bool, and then I proceed with products. And then so for products it's pointwise, but for the arrow I first get the divergence here. Why? Because well, you can look at the rules of the operational semantic which you would like to capture, and the operational semantics for applications says well, evaluate the argument, and if it doesn't diverge, evaluate the function. So apply the function to it and evaluate the result. That's why the semantics of this arrow type, as an arrow, where I do not have the divergence of the left hand, on the left-hand side, because I verified before that my argument is not diverging, but the result may diverge, because when I evaluate the function, the result can be a divergence. And then I define for every type I define the semantics of this type as so this this semantics of types, which I defined previously in one step, I need two steps to define it. So first I need to these assumptions, and then I introduce the semantics of a type, now seen A as a computation, and as a computation, it's either a value of type A or divergence. So it's, we differently structure the types, because we would need to tell the difference between computations and values. So then the this semantics of terms have this type. Okay, just like before, I use lots of rules to define this judgment. So for the unit type, it's like this. This is probably the first. No, actually, this is the same. I think it's the same as in called by name. So because the semantics of one, of the star is this, but due to this clause, we adjoin bottom. So, and hence, I need to put these brackets around it. Then there are variables. Okay, I forget the row, so there's always a row here. So this is PRI of row, where gamma is this. Then there are numbers. Right, and the booleans. same for false. Then there are operations. T1 and T2. Say A. This is defined in the same way as in call by name. Then P else. This is, I think, also like called by name. Okay, now there are some different cases, and it's about the pairs. So, as we've discussed last time, so pairs behave differently in call by name and call by value. And of course, we need to assign a different semantics because in call by value, as I said, we evaluate. We have to make sure that the components do not diverge. So we evaluate both components of the pair. And how we do it? Well, we can involve the let constructor. This let construct, we can say that we evaluate the first component, P, A, row, and then we evaluate the second component, Y, in let Y gamma Q, A, B. Row in X, Y. So that's the first big difference with call by name. So if we want to interpret a pair, what we are saying here is we are saying, okay, evaluate the first component, then evaluate the second component, and then return the pair lifted using these brackets. So at this point, we know that we don't diverge, because if we diverged, then we would fail before. And in this point, we know that we don't diverge, so we return this value. Sometimes I'm forgetting to use the round brackets for the pairs. So these angle brackets, they are supposed to refer to these internal pairs. But sometimes I just forget to use them, but I use the round ones, but they're supposed to mean the angle ones every time. So, and this is basically the key example, which explains how to do it in the other cases too. We interpret the pair strictly. So this command ensures strictness. If we want to make sure that if an argument fails, then the whole thing fails, then we use this construction to evaluate this argument and use the variable further. So this is how we get the strict pairs. And the same way we get strict projections. So PRIT is equal to let X gets T in X gets the semantics of T, so T is of type TAB in PRIX lifted. So what happens to the lambda abstraction? Lambda X T is equal to hurry So this is quite similar, I guess, to the call by name situation. And the example with application PQ A, or let's say B. Now this is again another crucial place where call by value differs from call by name. So before we feed the result, well, before we call Q, we evaluate P and the result we substitute to Q. So what does it mean in our notation? It means that we execute the semantics of P and then we execute the semantics of Q. And then we evaluate fx. So note the difference. In many places, we finish this let clause with in and then something lifted, because this was a value and we need to embed it into a pointed CPU. But this we need it because we know that thing in brackets doesn't diverge. So, but we need to provide, so for the type reasons, we need to embed it into something which potentially may diverge. This is not the case here, because the evaluation function already can diverge itself. So it produces, does it? No, actually. Right, what the output type of F? So the output type of F, according to the semantics of the function types, is like this. So this gives us A to B bottom. So when you just call this evaluation function here, where f was of type a to b bottom, so you get a b bottom in the end. So you don't need to lift it anymore. So, and finally, there is the there is this fixed point combinator. Let f gets row. F is bad. G. So I evaluate my argument F, and then I lift, so I apply this star, because otherwise it wouldn't type check, and call this mu function, this mu least fixed point, like we did in call by name. Maybe I can treat this clause in more detail. So we had f being of this type, and when we calculate the semantics, gamma f a to a, and we apply rho, then the result is of type so it's of type a underscore to a underscore bottom, and yet another bottom. So if you just apply this this inductive rules for the types, you would see that the type of the thing is this. So it's a function which may diverge, but then we lift it again because basically we convert a function to a value. And when we convert a function to a value, we always add at this bottom. Now, when I execute it here, so morally the type of this g is the same one, but with this bottom dropped. And now I wanted to use the fixed point theorem to this type, but I wouldn't be able to because these types must be the same. And they are not the same. So let me call it H. I apply the star, which lifts the argument. So I get this. No, this is not entirely correct. G star. So this G, which I obtained by executing this term, yields this. And if I apply the star, I get this. So now the types on the left and on the right match, and I can apply the mu, which I do, and I get this type as a result of the whole expression, and this matches with the semantics of the types. So the point of the star here is my function originally has this type, but I want to convert it to a function which also accounts for the divergence as an argument. So this function only says, if I have A, then I produce A or possibly diverge. But to apply the Klinge fixed point theorem, these types must be the same. So I need a function which would tell me, if I have A or divergence, tell me the result which is of type A or divergence. So I need to make this type conversion. And this type conversion is made by the star, which says if it's divergence, then the whole result is divergence. So this star operator, it completes the definition of my function from this to this. So it specifies it over divergent inputs too. And now I can rewrite this expression a bit more, because I know how this function is defined. So I can call the Klinge theorem. So mu g star is equal to the least upper bound of the sequences g star, etc. g star bottom, where this g star is repeated e times. So, and alternatively, I can write it as the, using the let notation. So I write something like let g bottom. No, wait a minute. Is it correct? Yeah, except that this is not G, it's just some x1, and I apply G to x1 and get x2. And so on. At some point, I get xn gets g of xn minus 1. And I return g of xn. Let me just rewrite it. Right, so I start with the bottom. No, at the very first iteration, I have to apply G star. Uh, So then I get a bottom. Yes, yeah, okay. So this is how it proceeds. This is essentially the unfolding of my least fixed point, and it's also the more intuitive explanation of the recursion, because when I say that I want to calculate the fixed point, this fixed point in call by value, what I'm saying is I initialize my computation with this, and then I execute it. If it doesn't fail, I bind the result to x1, and then I apply g to x1, and again, if I check if I'm failing, if I don't, then I bind the result to x2. At the next iteration, I use x2, etc. So there are n components. So I apply g to iterate g n times. So I think this this equation is more explanatory for this term here, because it reflects the semantics in the intuitive way as iterated execution. Do you have any questions about it? All right. So then this was the semantics. Now we can calculate the semantics of every term. And just like in the case of call by name, we can also establish the same facts that with respect to so what hopefully this example shows is that the sled constructor at plays a crucial role in this definitions for the denotational semantics of call by value, because it allows us to have certain syntactic sugar for reasoning about computations and evaluating a computation and obtaining a value. Right. So, but this is essentially what I wanted to present concerning the semantics. I next want to connect it with the further topics, and basically, as a forward reference, I just wanted to emphasize that the connection is indeed via the sled constructor. So it's a constructor which can be generalized. Here we have a very particular case of a notion of computation, which is basically which basically tells us that a computation is either a value or divergence. So there's a very simple thing which can happen with the computation except for providing just a result. So a computation either provides a result or fails. And in the future, we'll just see example where a computation is treated more broadly. And it may not only diverge, but it may provide non-determinism, for example. And in the same way, you can use this notation to reason about other effects except divergence. But you use just the same constructions for that. Okay, but this is something that we are going to do next. And apparently, I wanted to give some primer in Haskell because we somehow want to relate this to the examples. Show some basics. So now again, how it works. Do you remember where I switch it on? The projector? Any ideas? Well, right. We do not have a projector, do we? Ah, yes, we do have a projector. But where is the screen? Yes. Ah, just use the word. It's a very scientific approach. Right, and I need to marry the computer somehow with this. My computer doesn't see it so far. So this is I. Ah, no, I just. Right. So it's not running, I guess, is it? that's S video, yeah. So I tried video.
It already worked.
Yes, but I set up mirroring displays and then it stopped working. So should I use video or?
I don't know.
There are also computer one and computer two because probably there are two connections, but I also tried them both. Yes.
Hmm?
Yeah, just try. Okay. So, is it the quality is all right, or should pull down? Okay. So I made some notes for this intro. So basically, I don't know. It shouldn't touch it at all.
Is it connected loose or something?
Perhaps. Uh-huh. So I'm using Linux. I don't know what operation systems you have. There's a very detailed explanation how to install it and how to run it on the Haskell.org site. Hopefully you can use it. So for the time being, I would propose that we stick to this Haskell interpreter, which is GHCE. So there's also a Haskell compiler, GHC, and there is a command run Haskell, which works as a compiler but without compilation, so it's non-interactive interpreter. And so essentially, we can view Haskell as a combination of three features. So this is like the theoretical basic of it. If you view it from the theoretical perspective, it seems to be not more than this. So it's a combination of a lambda calculus and polymorphism and algebraic data types. So we have elaborated lambda calculus for some time. And I think this part should be the simplest thing. And there are these two other parts. All of them are interconnected, but one can consider them, try to consider them in isolation to some extent. So I would just go about lambda calculus component first. So when you run this Haskell interpreter, then you are provided with a command line where you can just execute commands. There are several commands which are helpful. So you can get the help, I guess, by saying something like, Yeah, so there's a list of commands, and not all of them are of immediate importance, but some of them are used quite often. So for example, this command type outputs the type of a term. So there is this prelude. So this word prelude, it's a library which is loaded by default, and it contains already some stuff like this id function. So id function is a polymorphic function, just the identity, and when I call this command, it will output the type. So then there is a command for outputting, for loading a module. So apart from the default things, which are already sufficient for things which we are going to do next, you might want to load something beyond it, like a library, data list, what? Is it lists? Ah, yes, data list. So now we loaded the library, a library about list operations. Then there is a command info, which tells you some information about terms and constructors. Yeah, I need to say what the constructor next. So like this, I guess. So it tells you the background information about how the thing, something was defined. So it was a constructor for lists, for example, and there's the definitions and further information. Then there is a command browse, which just outputs everything which is defined. And I mean, if you do it without loading list, it would output all the terms, all the functions defined in prelude. So if you just call this command without loading anything, it's instructive to go through this list and see what was defined there. So there is this lambda calculus notation. Well, okay, so I can basically start writing some terms. Like I can write something like this. So this is my lambda abstraction. This is the Haskell syntax for it. This stands for lambda x point x. And I can check the type of it. T. So the type is the same as the type of the constant of this identity function. Then we can do what? So there is the let notation. Well, first of all, I can just define things by equation by saying let something equal to, well, let's say square let square x be x times x. So if I execute it, then the square is a defined operation from now on, and I can check its type. So that, of course, contains this annotation, which I'm not going to explain now, but well, actually, you can, for the time being, read it as if a is a number, then the type of square is from a to a. Right. And just the same way, you can write something like let f x is equal to x in f2, say. So this is a combination of a definition, of a local definition, and the rest. So I'm just locally defining my square function, and I'm going to use it right away. So after executed, this will leave no traces of defined things after the execution is finished. So this let is essentially that let which we have just considered for the denotation of semantic. It's that one. Right. So what else? So let me just give you yet another example. Ah, okay. Do we have the const functor? Yeah, unfortunately we have it. So then I define my const. So I can just redefine it by saying that I send this to X. Right? So this is a lambda abstraction which returns a lambda abstraction which returns the first argument. Just very similar to what we've done. Okay, so like we considered like in PCF, this is a typed language. So if you want to write something like this, let me reuse this definition. If I want to write down something like this, I would have a type error because of that phenomenon. We cannot apply functions to themselves. So x applied to x wouldn't type check because there's essentially an equation which I showed in one of the previous lecture that t2 is equal to t2 arrow t1. So that cannot be solved. I'm not given the types, but the types are assigned automatically. And apparently there is no way to assign a type here. Then right, okay. So this const I defined as a function returning a function. And I can write something like this, my const 01, yes. So this constant combination returns the first argument. And this is the syntax for calling the defined function. I don't need any brackets here, just give the first argument and the second argument. But I could also define this const as a function from a Cartesian product. So I could write something like this. Right, so here's the argument is a pair. And if you check the type, then the type of it is the pair t, t, t2 to t. So that's an alternative which can be used too. So instead of that's the uncarried version of that myconst, the original myconst function. So right, I can further relate it to the things which have considered theoretically. So basically, I can define a factorial function, like say let fuck x is equal to if x equal to 0, well, x, let's say, smaller or equal 1, then 1 else x times fuck x minus 1. So this is the recursive definition, because I'm using this fuck in the on the right hand side. So I can calculate fuck 3. No, this is yes. So if x is smaller or equal, no, what was the sign for? No, I want to say smaller or equal 1.
Yeah, that's okay, but the end we still have fact.
Ah, shit. Right, okay. Thank you. Yeah, right. Yeah, so anyway, so this is a recursive definition. And this is different from the style of recursive definition that we had in PCF, because in PCF we only had a special fixed point operator, and if we wanted to write this definition, we would need to use the fixed point operator somehow. So I can like relate it by saying that I define in my fixed point operator here just by giving the operational equation for it. So that was my operational equation for the fixed point operator.
You have to use small letters for.
Yes, right. Let's call it fix. So this is how I define it, and now I can define the factorial differently by saying that fec x is equal to fix. No, so just my factorial function as fix. So what should be the argument of fix? Fix receives a function, let's say f. And that function takes an argument, say x, and the result is if x is equal to 1, then 1 else x times g x minus 1. F. So that's the things in the brackets are essentially the body of my function. So if I consider it, if I wanted to eliminate the recursion or make the recursion structural, I could write down a non-recursive definition, but wrap the fixed point combinator around it. So I forgot the let. Right, and then fec 3 is 6 again. So that's kind of connection between these two views. So we can do all kind of programming without the definition. The recursive, we can make all the definition non-recursive, but use the fixed point combinator instead as given. So there are some useful syntax I see that you essentially know about it sufficiently. Perhaps, I don't know if this is new for someone. No. So for whom it's new? So from to no one. Okay. Then I'm not going to explain these details about the operations, about the syntactic sugar. So basically, I wanted to relate to the theoretical stuff. So, and this is, I've done this here. All right. So I wanted to demonstrate the laziness and show that it corresponds to the notion of laziness or call by name that we have seen previously. So I can define my omega divergent term. So I can say that right, fix. So omega is like iterating the identity. So this is a divergent function, and if I just So if I run it, then it doesn't finish, obviously. And then I can show you this example, which distinguishes between call by value and call by name. If we have const, which we run this like this. And so since we are called by name, then we ignore the divergence on the second argument, and we just return zero. So in call by value, it wouldn't work. We still can model this, the call by value behavior. There is the special connectivity here, which is dollar bang, which says I want to be strict on this argument. So strict in the sense of preserving the divergence. So if I run it, then I diverge again because I enforce the call by value semantics here, essentially. So if you check the type of this thing, and then the type is like the type of the evaluation function. So there is this this dollar sign, which is a syntactic sugar for application, and there's a dollar bang, which is also application. So the types are the same, but the behavior is different because the thing with the bang is the strict evaluation. So that's the standard practice in Haskell, that bang always mean, well, tends to mean strictness. So you can meet it in other places too. And it refers to strictness. Right. I don't know. So this is what I wanted to tell about this component. So lambda calculus, quite straightforward, more or less. So there's some syntactic sugar on top of it, but essentially it's that. But what the it's related to polymorphism. So these two things stick together, and already in this example you see that we are polymorphic because this A and B are generic types. So I do not give them, they are just derived, automatically generated, and if I apply my function to something more concrete, then the function gets automatically more specific. It becomes more specific. Which order I would like to use? Okay. Yeah, perhaps let's talk about this phenomenon, which is essentially the second component here. So it's polymorphism, and there are actually two important types of polymorphism that Haskell supports. And the first type of polymorphism is parametric and the second is ad hoc. So the parametric polymorphism is the simpler one, and in this example, you see it already. So it means that the things which we are defining, they are parametrized. Like this application here is parametrized by the two parameters A and B. And the definition of this thing, of the things which are defined parametrically polymorphic, the definitions do not depend on any additional information. They define something in terms, well, without referring to any particular information about the types. So an example would be like what? Like reverse. So this reverse is a parametrically polymorphic function. So it goes from list to list. And it's polymorphic in the sense that we provide it without having any information about the elements. So we don't need to know anything about A to write down this function. Hence, it's parametrically polymorphic. And the best way to understand, to see the bound, the boundaries of this polymorphy, parametric polymorphism is by comparison with other sorts of polymorphism. And the other sorts of polymorphism here is ad hoc, which means that essentially we define a function, a generic function, different, which instantiates to different things depending on that how we specify this definition. And a particular example of this sort of polymorphism, this ad hoc polymorphism, is the definition of the arithmetic operations of the numbers. So if we define sums over natural and sums over floating point numbers, we mean something different. So the implementation is different every time, but we use the same symbol. And here, the simplest example would be this case of the sort function, I guess. That provides, I think, the simplest example where you can do the comparison. So the sort function does a sorting of a list. It has essentially, well, very similar type as the reverse, but it has an additional claim here on the left-hand side of the arrow. So here we are not polymorphic in the same way as we are polymorphic here, because in case of sort, we need some information about the elements of the list. We need to know how they can be compared. So we cannot write a sort function for arbitrary lists. We can write it only for those lists for which the elements have a notion of order. And this is what this implication says. If A is such type that that supports a notion of ordering, then we can sort it. So I think this is a nice example to see the difference. Okay. Right. So I wanted to shortly go about the numbers. So if you do as I suggested and just run this browse command, then this there are going to be a big list. There are going to be a big list, and lots of entries in this list will be about some operations with numbers and some types of numbers. And this has a lot to do with the polymorphism, as I just explained now. Essentially, the philosophy of Haskell is such that if you can define something generically, then you should do it. Because, and this is done by default, so when you write a command like square, so where was my square? So I didn't assign any type to it. I just said a square x is equal to x times x. And Haskell find the most general type for it itself. So it suggests me to use the most general type. It suggests it when I do not provide any type, but the whole philosophy suggests this approach. So if you want to implement some function, it's welcome to do it in such a way that this function is parametric, is polymorphic, and used in many occasions. So for the square, the generated type was this one. It says that the function that I defined is ad hoc polymorphic according to this definition, and a is expected to be a numeric type. So to form the multiplication x times x, this A must be a number. What means a number? So this num A, well, you can see it as a predicate. It states that A supports some very general operations of numbers, like, I don't even remember, so like plus and multiplication. So, and suggested that this is the like the general generic type for numbers. Sometimes you must be more specific, because sometimes you need to use numbers which are like integers. And there are two extremes here. So there is this. Actually, I still can write here. So there is the integral. I don't remember if it's integer or int. Maybe someone can tell me. So there, I think there are integers and int, and both of them are machine implemented integers, right? So okay. So one is, I think, like arbitrary precision, but which one do you remember?
Quantized
and integers. Yeah. Okay. I can write integer here then. So the this is like too extreme. This is like. I want to. I use this type if I want to declare a function which behaves like integers, more or less. If I need to behave it like an integer, and this it's like the most general extreme, and this is the most particular extreme, when these are integers indeed. So, and the difference is this is a type class like num. So it doesn't introduce an actual type, it just specifies a type. It says, so it's inherited from this num class, and I don't quite remember which operations it adds, but it adds the operations for dealing with integers. And yeah, so the Haskell way would be to use it whenever you can use it. Because then the definition, the function that you program, it would apply to many occasions. So this is like, I don't know, if you cannot do it by all means, you really need the two integers, then you use the two integers that can be important for performance reasons. And a similar story happens with floating point arithmetic. So there is a class floating. And okay, that must be float, I guess, or real float. Let me just check it. Yeah, I think that's something in between. So there's this floating clause, and there's like a more specific real float. And there must be, float, right? And float and double. So this is the most general class for the floating point arithmetic. And this is like a one, which is like this one, but which you can convert to the real numbers. So there are there is a conversion function from maybe I don't know how to precisely compare these two things. So there's also things like real and rational. So here the relation is like with integral and integers. So real are like integers, like abstract rationals, and for the float floating point arithmetic, I do not actually know how to how the hierarchy looks like precisely, but apparently the floating is somewhere in the top, and this concrete types, they are somewhere in the bottom, and there is something in between. So I mean, in the concrete cases, you have to look at these types and see what is more suitable for a concrete example. So I probably just give such an example quickly. Right, so I have... I have a small example which helps me to calculate to check if a number is prime. So I can write it like this. So I define a predicate is prime. So if it's greater than one and rem x divided by 2x gets. So this would be a program which gives an answer yes if my number was one. And this condition was true. So what this condition says is I check the list right from 2 to square of n. So this function, I didn't define it yet, in square to n. So it's a rounded square root of n. And for every element of this list, I check if it produces zero by division, if n produces zero by division on this number. And this end predicate applied to a list just checks if I've got true for all elements. So if my number is prime, that I only need only can have truths in this list, and I don't need to verify more than the integer square of n. This is a very well known fact. So you don't need to check the numbers from 2 to n. It suffices to check the numbers from 2 to square of n. So this doesn't work because I didn't define this function, and this function is I define like this. Int s QRT. Something looks nonsensical here. I probably again didn't record this version. So I want to. From integral Alright, I think, I do not have time to fix it, so I'll just show it next time, because the time is over. I didn't record the last version, somehow I forget the name of the functions which I needed. Okay.